Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, this is Martina Navratilova, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. A couple of days after Novak Djokovic took his record this year to 78-5 defeats. Is it a big one? Charlie Eccleshare has been asking that on the Telegraph Sport website. Is the big four a thing of the past? Is it now a big one? We'll discuss that here on the Tennis Podcast. He beat Andy Murray in the final yet again, 6-2, 6-4 this time. Murray now onto the clay at Queen's with the 0-2 on an indoor hard court just a few days away. So it's a very strange, unusual system of preparing for the O2, isn't it, for Andy Murray at the moment? Venus Williams, aged 35, won the WTA Elite Trophy in Zhuhai to move back inside the world's top 10. She's up at number 7 in the world now. We'll be talking about that. We'll also be answering your questions sent in via @tennispodcast, and we'll be hearing from John McEnroe, who played in his first Davis Cup singles rubber in the 1978 final, condemning Great Britain to defeat the last time that Britain were in the Davis Cup by BNP Paribas final. McEnroe remembers that on the Tennis Podcast and gives his predictions for the final between Britain and Belgium in a few weeks' time. First, though, Catherine Whittaker, safe to say that you and I have had very contrasting Mondays.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, we were supposed to have very similar Mondays, and it just didn't quite work out that way. Yours was about 10,000% more glamorous than mine, David. You were...
And enjoyable, yes. I was hobnobbing with the great and good of tennis with Pat Cash and Tim Hemman and the tournament director of the Aegon Championship, Stephen Farrow. We all went down to the BBC studios for the live Chris Evans breakfast show on BBC Radio 2, which has an audience of more than 10 million people. Every year they do an auction for children in need, and we put together what is known as the Ultimate Tennis Package, which gave people chance to go to the 8 winning bidders. If they bid enough money, they would get to go to the Albert Hall for Champions Tennis in the first week of December, play on the Albert Hall court, just as you and I did last year, Catherine, and we know how good that is, as long as you don't lose. And also, they get to have fantastic seats, they'll get a backstage tour, they get to go to Queen's later on next year and take part in the official draw, play in a pro-am, do the coin toss. The top two bidders would hit a few balls with Andy Murray. Oh, my word. And how about this, Catherine? The ultimate part of the auction prize was that the 8 winning bidders would get to put a question on the Tennis Podcast to John McEnroe.
Yeah, that's
how cool's that?
That's what really reeled in the big bucks, I think. It was the prospect of having their name read out on the Tennis Podcast. I mean, I think we are almost wholeheartedly responsible for the £285,000 raised for a wonderful charity, frankly.
£285,000, more than a quarter of £1 million raised by tennis inside an hour, and the vast majority of it down to the Tennis Podcast. Absolutely right, Catherine Whittaker, well said. And as we were saying, Catherine was meant to be part of this whole setup and helping to get the players where they need to go. But, Catherine Whittaker, didn't quite work out like that, did it?
No, I had to ditch Pat Cash at the last minute. Sorry, Pat, if you're listening. No, I've had a torrid couple of days with a very ill-timed illness. Back to almost fighting fit now. I mean, the good news, though, David, is I think it might be responsible for my speedy recovery. Sky Broadband have been in touch. I know everyone's been on the edge of their seat to know the end to the Catherine Whittaker Sky Broadband saga. And they've been in touch and offered me some form of monetary reimbursement, along with their profuse apologies for what was a very traumatic Sunday without internet while Nadal and Federer was going on. So, yeah, there is a happy ending after all.
Oh, well, there we go. Sky Broadband, almost back in the good books. Let's see if they actually come through. Catherine, the Paris tournament went, frankly, to form, didn't it? Novak Djokovic is just continuing where he left off. I was looking at his record for the year. Only once all year has he failed to reach a final. 14 out of 15 tournaments he's played, he's reached the final. It's just getting more and more one-sided. It is, as Charlie Eccleshare said in the Telegraph Sport website, it feels like a big one now. It doesn't feel like a big four.
Yeah, I think that was a very good article from Charlie in the Telegraph, because he's bang right. There's more of a gulf, both on paper, you know, the gulf in ranking points is as big as it's been between the number one and the number two. And in reality, I think the gulf between the number one and the number two is far bigger than it's been in recent history. And I would include all of the dominant Federer years in that. And that's entirely down to Novak Djokovic, because I think the 2, 3, 4, and 5 are, they haven't got worse. They're still extraordinarily good tennis players, as good if not better as Federer's rivals were back when he was at his peak dominance. It's just Novak Djokovic is head and shoulders better than them, and I'm desperate for someone to step up. I would just love to see that credible rival to Novak Djokovic, and maybe Novak Djokovic would too.
Well, I'm not sure he would. I think he's quite happy just putting the beat down on everybody in the world, frankly. But what I do think is, whereas I think people are starting to fear for 2016 and a continuation of the monster year, as Brad Gilbert put it on the tennis podcast earlier this year, that Novak Djokovic had in 2015, I actually am more intrigued by what the field will do about it in 2016, because I think it's pretty rare that you get a player dominating for 12 months and then able to just do exactly the same thing the following year. I think that the field gets remotivated, if anything, and is looking and always trying to figure out ways. I think they even talk amongst themselves, you know. How do we get past this guy? I remember when Leighton Hewitt was world number one. I remember
they'd be stupid not to talk amongst themselves, surely.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, they share notes, these players. I remember Tim Henman and Todd Martin at Queens one year when one of them got to, I think, the quarterfinals. I think Todd Martin got to the quarterfinals and actually took a set off Hewitt when Hewitt was the dominant grass court player. He was winning the tournament year after year. He won Wimbledon. And I think that he actually said to Tim, listen, what got me that set was throwing, in inverted commas, junk in the direction of Leighton Hewitt rather than hitting really good shots at him and powerfully struck shots. You might be better off throwing all sorts of weird stuff at him because it might throw him out of his rhythm. And I remember Henman actually gave that a go in the next round. He actually admitted to doing that. So I think that will happen. I think that players are going to come out remotivated in 2016 to try to find a way past Novak Djokovic and derail him a little bit. Let's not forget that it was only a bloke of nearly 7 feet tall who managed to actually stop him before a final. That was Ivo Karlovic in the first tournament of the year in Doha. But the bigger question for me is there any danger, do you think, of Novak Djokovic suffering a little bit from a lack of motivation in 2016, given that he's dominating so much?
I would be really surprised if that were the case. I really would. I know that is something that can happen. I would just be extremely surprised if it happened to Novak Djokovic, because his motivation is records. His motivation is to go down in tennis history in the way that Federer will and the way that Nadal will. And, of course, many, many others before him. And it's now within his grasp, amazingly. The monster year he's had in 2015 has suddenly elevated him from, you know, a very good sort of second string, you know, an Andy Murray level player who'll go down as having won a few Grand Slams, we don't know how many, to a genuine contender for one of the all-time greats. And what bigger motivation can there be than that? And I really think that's what gets him out of bed in the morning more than anything else at the moment. And why would that change in 2016? And there's been no sign of any kind of complacency from him. I mean, he's so far and away ahead of everybody else. You could forgive him a little complacency, especially at this time of the year when he's played more matches than anybody else. And yet he still is showing up and playing as well, if not better, than you at various other times throughout the year. I mean, I'm dumbfounded by his level, really. And yes, I think there will be a renewed challenge from the best of the rest. But boy, have they got a lot of ground to make up just at the moment.
I have to say, Catherine, Twitter agrees with you. Because I put the question out at Tennis Podcast on Twitter. Is Novak Djokovic going to suffer any form of motivation loss the way that Chelsea football team have so far in 2015, this new season? Chris Fowler's team, who we had from ESPN on the Tennis Podcast earlier this year.
That's a very simplistic assessment of Chelsea's woes this season, I would just like to add. I think there's more going on than lack of motivation, but That's a discussion for another podcast, I would say.
It is. Andy says, you're kidding, aren't you? I can see a calendar slam in 2016 for Novak Djokovic. I can see him topping Roger Federer's title haul. He's that dominant. Kelvin says, no motivation loss for Djokovic in 2016. He has records in his sights. Timothy Cameron says, no chance. He wants to beat Federer's slam record and win the French. If anything, he'll have more motivation. The ultimate Serena Williams fan says, I doubt it. He'll be even more motivated. He hasn't won the French. He still has the calendar, the career slam or the calendar slam as motivators. And finally, Hugh says, even my favourite media tennis account is talking about Chelsea. Can't look anywhere without being reminded how awful we are.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just, you're setting yourself up for that. If you insist on being a Chelsea fan, my friend, you've just got to accept the abuse that comes your way. Other football teams are available with whom you will receive less abuse. I mean, yeah, I'm pleased that Twitter so wholeheartedly echoes my sentiments, and I do completely. I obviously agree with all of them, and they agree with me. How unusual.
Yeah, how unusual, absolutely.
He is 16-1. I looked up the odds the other day to do the Golden Slam next year, which would include the Olympics, of course, which has never been done in the men's game. It was done by Steffi Graf in the women's game in 1988. And I think that does have to come with the caveat of the Olympics was not what it is today in tennis terms. So 16-1 is, I mean, I don't doubt that it's accurate odds, but that's extraordinarily short odds for what would be the biggest, most monumental achievement in men's tennis that there has ever been.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Andy Murray, Catherine, got to the final, had a good week, beat David Goffin in what we were all billing as a rehearsal for the Davis Cup by BNP Paribas final. And he found his way to the final pretty easily, as he has been doing a number of times this year. But also, as happened, aside from one occasion in Canada earlier this year, ran into Novak Djokovic and just had no chance.
Yeah, I have to say, there wasn't really any point in that match where I thought Andy Murray had a chance, I'm afraid. It was, yes, he mounted some challenge at various points. You know, he rallied a bit in that second set to break back, but then Djokovic broke immediately again, and it always had that feel of, I'm going to use the term, David, that's got me into trouble before, it had the feel of a foregone conclusion about it, I think.
Yeah, that is a phrase that Catherine Whittaker has until this point, banned from her vocabulary, and rightfully so. I have to say, I was watching that match on replay that evening and trying to work out what is happening with Andy Murray here. Is it just that he's simply not as good as Novak Djokovic? My conclusion was, I mean, given that he's beaten him nearly 10 times, he obviously is capable of doing so, although I accept that this is a different Novak Djokovic to the one that we've seen in many of those matches before. My view is that they're very similar, and Novak Djokovic is just better at doing the things that Andy Murray typically does to everybody else. He's a better, slightly better mover. He has a significantly better second serve. And as a result of all those things, and his mental strength is more consistent, and the resilience is just extraordinary. He doesn't hurt himself when he gets upset. He actually improves, whereas I think sometimes Murray can hurt himself. But I think the big thing is when Nadal and Murray first started playing against each other, the same situation applied. The best of Nadal was better than Murray's normal disposition, and Murray had to take it to Nadal in a way that he didn't have to do that against anybody else. And I think we saw that, it was in Montreal, wasn't it, in that final, where Murray was able to do that and knock Djokovic off the court, albeit a Djokovic that wasn't quite at the peak of his powers that day. And I think that that's really what it comes down to. If Andy Murray's going to beat the guy, he has to play like that. And the problem is he can't miss very much.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would put it down to. I think the most significant actual technical difference in their games where Djokovic has a big advantage over Murray is that second serve. It is better. That's probably the one area where I'd say Djokovic is just better. And I think that affects mental resilience. I think it's, there's that old adage, which probably applies less in modern tennis than it has done, but you're only as good as your second serve. And if that's the case for Andy Murray, that's a damning assessment, because he does have one of the weakest second serves of anybody near the top of the game, I would say. And that's, of course, a testament to the rest of his game that he manages to overcome that. But I think the weakness of that second serve has an impact on the whole of the rest of your game and how, you know, players approach it. You know, he misses his first serve and your opponent's rubbing their hands together thinking, all right, I've got a chance here. But in terms of, take that aside, and I would say the biggest difference is, you know, when they're both playing their absolute best, which we have seen on occasion this year, there were moments in that Australian Open final where they were both playing their best. I think they're pretty well matched, but Djokovic plays his best almost 100% of the time, even in the pressure situations, in the biggest moments, whereas Andy Murray goes in and out of his best. You know, in that Australian Open final over best of five sets, he just couldn't maintain it. And for me, that's the biggest difference. When do you ever see Djokovic's level dip for more than a fleeting moment at any point? You know, even at this point in the season, when they must be mentally, if not physically fatigued, you still don't see his mind go for a wander ever. His focus doesn't wane.
Yeah, I would agree with the vast majority of what you said there. I do recall during that Montreal-Cincinnati period, I remember you saying on the tennis podcast, Novak Djokovic is not playing very well. And the truth is, by his standards, you were right, he wasn't. Yet he still reached the finals. And that's the difference as well. Even if he's some way short of his best, he's able to compete. His resilience, his competitive spirit, his standard level is just still so high. He doesn't throw in dud performances. He might be some way off peak Djokovic, but, oh, goodness me, 90% Djokovic is good enough to beat the vast majority.
Yeah, I would just like to say his only dud performance of the year was against Ivo Karlovic in Doha. His very first match of the year, and I watched that match live. I was in Doha. It was played practically during a sandstorm, and I do think Ivo Karlovic with that serve, I mean, a serve was basically the only shot you could properly hit in those conditions. So, I mean, the fact that that was probably the only dud performance and it was played in those sorts of conditions, I think, says an awful lot about Novak Djokovic's 2015.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Incidentally, Andy Murray, now we were talking about it, he's gone, as the tennis writers were saying, the ones that were in Paris, they spoke to him afterwards about his plans. He's going to go and practice on the clay. As he said, or as you were saying in the tennis podcast last week, and you have done on Twitter a couple of times this week, if he does feel the back or if he starts to feel some sort of injuries, he said himself that he then wouldn't play the O2. He fully intends to do that at the moment, to play that tournament, but he's going to play for a few days on clay. So a big few days coming up for Andy Murray, and in terms of how it goes over the next couple of weeks, I would expect, Catherine, overall that he will play both. I think he does look in pretty good physical nick, and, well, just fingers crossed that he shows no adverse effects.
I would too. I'm expecting him to play, but Andy Murray is very, and with very good reason, but he's very precious about his body, isn't it? You know, in his semi-final against David Ferrer in Paris, you know, as soon as things started to hit a bad shot or had a bad rally, his reflex was to grab at his back, and I don't think he was actually feeling his back. Maybe he was, but it was almost just an instinct. A couple of times he just went for his back, and then.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sort of retracted his hand as if, oh no, sorry, I was just checking that my back was okay. So I do think, you know, if he feels the slightest thing, the slightest twinge, the slightest indication that continuing to play or changing back to the hard courts might cause him further difficulties, I don't think he's going to take that lightly. I don't expect him to go, oh well, you know, I'm only feeling a minor twinge. I would expect him to respond quite seriously to anything of in that direction. So it all just, I think it just, I mean, these are the critical moments. As we're speaking, we understand he's hitting with Aliash Bedene, I understand, on the clay courts at the Queen's Club just down the road from me. So these are the crucial moments. We will know in the coming days what is to be the fate of Andy Murray at the O2. And I'm sure the tournament organisers and everybody with a vested interest, the BBC and Sky Sports, are very much on the edge of their seats.
And another critical element to all this is whether Aliash Bedene has his appeal successfully going in his favour in terms of trying to overturn the verdict of the ITF in not allowing him to play for Great Britain in the Davis Cup currently. Because if it does get overruled, then he would become, in theory, available, even though he has said that he might find that a bit awkward, given that he hasn't played any of the ties to get to that point. Although, Catherine Whittaker, we should also remind that John McEnroe didn't play any of the singles rubbers in the lead up to the United States getting to the Davis Cup final in 1978. And we can hear from John McEnroe about that now, because that was the last time that Great Britain were in the Davis Cup final. And John McEnroe remembers it well.
Well, I had played my first match in Chile in doubles only, and then I was passed over to play the semifinal match when we beat Sweden, where Bjorn actually played. And I had actually beaten Bjorn for the first time in 1978, just a couple months earlier. But I think it was just after maybe the Davis Cup at that time. And so I was disappointed that I wasn't picked to play singles in the semis. And it was sort of a, you know, I was still just 19 in December of 78. I don't recall ever even being to Palm Springs where we played the event and at the Davis Cup final. And it was a bit of a, I guess, a risk, you could say, that Tony Traber picked me to play captain. But I sort of come into my own the last few months of that year and had won a three or four events at, towards the end of the year. So I was finally starting to play the type of tennis that I felt like I was capable of. And it just, everything sort of just seemed to work like perfectly for me. For whatever reason that I don't, can't explain, because I didn't have, I rarely played Palm Springs in the future. I didn't feel like I had success there, and I didn't like the dryness and the dry heat and having to go indoors, outdoors. But for whatever reason there, my game like clicked perfectly, and it was like, I was in sort of the zone when I played Lloyd and Mottram, and I think Mottram had ended up actually beating Gottfried in the second singles match, so it was actually 1-1 after the first day, and so it was still competitive when I played Mottram the final match, and it felt like I wish everything could be that easy. I look back, because I only lost like 10 games in 2 matches, I think.
Pretty good. It's pretty good. Maybe Britain will win this one.
Turns out it's not always that easy.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Do you think we'll win this one?
You know, to me, Great Britain should win. You know, I think it's set up. Like, obviously Murray, you know, there's going to be some pressure, but the way he's operated with Australia, that's the way it's going to pan out to me the next time, you know. I mean, he's going to win 2 singles, and it would be sort of nice if he was able to do it one more time with his brother. Definitely going to be the favorite. It's a little harder when you play on the road, but I pick Great Britain. Well, you see, it depends who they play the other match, but even the second singles, you know, they got an outside shot at winning that. So, you know, to me, they should win that 8 out of 10 times.
So John McEnroe, Catherine, reckons that Great Britain are firm favourites for the Davis Cup final by BNP Paribas. I think we would agree with that. I think most people would agree with that, but he seems really sure.
Yeah, there are a few people out there that are really sure, that really, really have an awful lot of confidence in it. I don't have quite the same conviction. I do think GB are heavy, heavy favourites. And I found David Goffin's comments after his annihilation by Andy Murray in Paris. I found those comments a bit bizarre. He said he sort of walked onto the court defeated, and he knew it was going to be the last match of his season, and in his head he didn't give himself any chance against Andy Murray. Well, either those, I put it out on Twitter, either those are extremely complex mind games, or that was a very naive, rash thing to say in post-match press, which is entirely possible and justifiable given what an absolute thrashing he'd just experienced. But I did find that a bit bizarre. You know, he's there, David Goffin is unquestionably going to have to win both his singles matches, I think, to give Belgium any chance in that time. For him to, so which would mean, of course, beating Andy Murray. So for him to come out of that match and say, well, I went into it not thinking I had a chance of beating Andy Murray, I found highly bizarre, I have to say.
That's not necessarily true, though, is it, Catherine? Because if he were to lose against Andy Murray, win his other singles match, and the second player on Belgium's team win their singles match, and Belgium win the doubles, they could win that tie.
They could. That's not how I see it going, though. I think David Goffin needs to beat Andy Murray on the clay in Belgium. And no doubt it will be very different. I don't expect any 6-love or 6-1 scoreline, but Andy Murray is the favourite for that match, regardless of surface or, you know, crowd support. But David Goffin needs to be going into that match with Andy Murray thinking, I can win this and I need to win this for my country. And what he said,
he needs to be thinking that, but I think Belgium's chance is much better of winning the other two rubbers. And the doubles.
Possibly, although Aliash Bedene up against Steve Darcis.
Bedene is a very, very outside chance of even playing.
Yeah, but I mean, even James Ward up against Steve Darcis. I mean, you know, it's the rankings golf there is not much at all. I mean, hang on a second. We spoke in the week, and I thought the chatter was that Ali Ashbedene, it was looking more likely with every day that goes by that he would win that appeal. If he wins that appeal, how can you not pick him? How can you not pick your highest ranked second player to play? I know it would be awkward.
Well, it is a two-pronged approach here. First of all, he hasn't won it yet, so he's got to win that first. And I would say that is 50-50 at best, personally, in terms of his chances of winning that appeal, because it is no foregone conclusion, to use that expression again, but there's a lot to go through in order for him to actually win that appeal. Then he's got to be picked. So there's two elements to that. I don't think you can count on Ali Ashbedene being part of that final field. He might be, but I wouldn't guarantee it. And therefore, if you are then saying that you think that there's more chance of David Goffin beating Andy Murray than there is of Steve Darcy's beating James Ward, I disagree.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that at all. Maybe I should row back a little, but do you not think you're avoiding commenting on David Goffin's post-match comments last week in Paris? What did you make of those? I mean, okay, even if he doesn't necessarily have to be Andy Murray in that Davis Cup tie, he can't be going in with anything like the mentality that he hinted at in those post-match comments.
No, I agree with that. I think he needs to go in with a positive frame of mind, and I think you obviously need to try to win the match and feel good playing the other one as well. But I don't necessarily read that much into it. It's the end of a season. It's indoors. It's not on clay. I think he will be. And the thing is, it was interesting going on Twitter afterwards, and the amount of dismissing of David Goffin after that result, just because he lost heavily in that match. I can't see it going anything like that in the Davis Cup final. I think Goffin will be a completely different animal. I think Andy Murray, if it got to a final day, he will have a lot of nerves to deal with. He will have a very fatigued body to deal with. I still think he's the favourite. I still think he would win. But it would not just be, oh, Andy Murray's number two in the world. He's up against David Goffin. He looks about 8 years old. No problem. I just don't buy it.
Well, I do agree with you there. I'm gonna go back, because I think you, I mean, I know that it's still a hypothetical, and you're right that we're a long way from it being a foregone conclusion that Ali Ashbedene will win that appeal. But we love to deal with hypotheticals on the Tennis Podcast, David. So I am going to make you, let's just for a moment assume he wins it. Do you pick him? Come on.
That's a good question. Do I pick him? That's a very good question. I think if Andy Murray's all right with it, you pick him.
How could Andy? Do you think there's a chance that Andy Murray wouldn't be all right with it?
No, I think Andy Murray would be all right with it. And I think I would pick him based on that, because he is...
I can tell you he wouldn't be all right with it.
Well, there's plenty of people who wouldn't be all right with it. James Ward, Dan Evans, Kyle Edmund, none of them would be all right with it, would they, really? I mean, let's be honest, I'm sure they'd all want Great Britain to win. But would you be all right with it? I would be completely annoyed with it, even if it's understandable.
No, I'd be incandescent.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, if I was Leon Smith, and as long as I could be assured that my number one player was backing that decision as well, and that the doubles team were okay with it, I'd go with the guy most likely to win that second singles rubber, which is exactly what he did by picking Dan Evans in that tie against Australia a few weeks ago.
Well, there you go, Leon. David Law has spoken.
But what's it got to do with me? And also, I still think that it is very much up in the air about whether he will win that appeal. I mean, I have no inside knowledge other than the fact that I'm sure it is not just straightforward. So anyway, we will see. It's another intriguing potboiler, isn't it, that we just have to look forward to see what happens with that. Now, just before we go, Venus Williams, Catherine, I can't get over how impressive what she has done yet again this year has been. 35 years of age, 21st year as a tennis professional, and she's, I mean, you talked about it, in her being in Singapore, just waiting around to see if she got in as an alternate. That's how she spent her week. And then she goes off to Zhuhai and she's playing players like Karolina Pliskova in the final. You know, top players. And she beat the lot. She won the title. Number seven in the world.
She is amazing. She is absolutely amazing. She's an inspiration to sort of swathes of women and men everywhere. I think she's the oldest player to feature in the top 10 since Martina Navratilova, who was 38 and in the top 10 in 1995. I'd be surprised if Venus was still around in 3 years, but hey, I'd have been surprised 3 years ago if you'd told me in 3 years' time she'd be back in the top 10. So, I mean, she surprises everybody in the best possible way. I think it's such a shame that she didn't jump into that top eight in time for Singapore, because I think it seemed such a waste of everything that Venus Williams brings that she was there and yet couldn't play. You know, it's a tough gig being an alternate. They have to be on site, warmed up and ready ahead of every group stage match, ready to step in at, you know, up to a moment's notice. It's not like you're just hanging around having a holiday in Singapore and maybe you'll get the call. It's a really tough gig. Plenty of people turned down being an alternate, and it's not like she hasn't been there and done it all before. I'm sure the fact that she was playing in Zhuhai the next week was an incentive for her to stay in that part of the world. But I mean, unfortunately, we don't hear that much from her anymore, do we? Which is understandable, because, you know, she's been speaking to the media for the last 21 years of her life. But I'd love to hear a really, really in-depth interview that properly gets under her skin to really understand where she's getting the motivation from, because I'm amazed by it. I'm constantly amazed by it, and I think she's incredible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I have to say, if I could have one tennis wish for 2016, it would be for her to win another Grand Slam title.
Oh, that, I mean, who wouldn't rejoice in that? It would be amazing. Wimbledon 2016 could happen.
All right, done. Catherine Whittaker and I have decided here on the Tennis Podcast. A couple of questions just to finish off with Catherine, because we are nearly out of time this week. We got a corker here from Ali, who says, who wins a slam first, Jamie Murray or Dom Inglot?
Jamie Murray, I think.
Dom Inglot's starting to put them together now, isn't he?
He's going to get
some results.
He's going great guns, but Jamie Murray, of course, will be playing with a new partner next year, which is going to be interesting. I mean, he's not always adjusted to changes in partners that well, and I suppose Dom Inglot is well bedded in now with Robert Lindstedt. So, I mean, I don't think I'd certainly think Dom Inglot's in there with a shout, and it's great to see him doing so well.
Why has Jamie Murray stopped with John Peers? That is a strange one, isn't it? We didn't get a chance to discuss that the other week. Here he is, he's had basically the best year of his career. He's got to the O2 and he's stopped playing with John Peers. I imagine it's something to do with the fact that those two Grand Slam finals didn't go particularly well.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed Jamie Murray and John Peers after that defeat in the US Open final. And I have to say, the body language was not great. It didn't feel like a sort of mutual, it didn't feel like there was a no blame policy in place, if you like, which I would guess there sort of has to be in order for a doubles team to survive crushing defeats, you know, if you start blaming one another. I don't know if there were recriminations behind the scene. I just know that at the time I did have in the back of my mind, this doesn't look like a partnership. Doesn't look like the sort of partnership you'd expect from players that are really going from strength to strength on the court. It didn't look quite right off the court. You know, when one of them was speaking, the other one was looking in any other direction than at his partner. And when they were walking down the corridor to come to press together, they weren't walking together. They were very much separate. So as much as it might come as a surprise, having seen how well they've been doing on the court, for me, I did have in the back of my mind that that could be a decision that was coming.
I would just about go with Jamie Murray as well, because I think Bruno Suarez is a very, very good doubles player. Whether they gel is another matter. And certainly, as you said, Dom Inglot and Robert Lindstedt have been an extremely good partnership. We'll just do one more question. We've got loads of them here, but we're not going to get time for them all on this edition of the Tennis Podcast, so we'll try to get to them on another occasion. We have one here from Tevon, who says, Azarenka and Murray Both have failed to win a Grand Slam title now since 2013. Do you see them winning another one before they retire, Azarenka and Murray?
I think they both should. Yes, I do. I think Azarenka...
Will they? Will they?
Yes, I think they both will. There you go.
I agree. Which one's going to win which?
I think Azarenka has a good shout pretty much anywhere. I mean, I wouldn't rule her out for the Australian Open. She's always played well there. She just needs to put it all together. I know this year's been a tough one earlier. She actually did an extremely honest, very revealing interview. I think it was with ESPN in the week, talking about, you know, her changes in coach this year and how she struggled with being, you know, outside the seeded position. She's been that dangerous lurker in the draw for the whole year, and I'm sure that was a great novelty to start with, but she needs to get herself back in that top 10. She needs to be a top seed for the Grand Slams so she doesn't have to keep playing these big blockbuster matches in the second round. As great as it is for us spectators to see Azarenka, Wozniacki, or whatever it might be in the second round of a slam, she needs to be saving herself for the latter stages. And if she can just chip away and get back up there, she absolutely should be winning more slams.
Yeah, indeed. I agree with you. They can, frankly, both win all of the slams if things go their way. But I do feel that in Murray's case, he probably needs Djokovic to run into somebody else, or because he's played him a number of times now in big finals, big Grand Slam finals, and he's given him good matches, but he just hasn't been able to outlast him. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. And it is going to be all happening in 2016. I think we're in for a cracking year. Still got plenty more of this year to come as well. We've got the O2 ATP World Tour final starting this weekend. Following that, we've got the Davis Cup by BNP Paribas final in Belgium. Then we've got the Champions Tennis at the Royal Albert Hall. Oh, Catherine Whittaker, it is all happening. Now, do try to get through a week without getting ill, will you?
I make no promises. It doesn't seem to be in my hands, but I will do my very best, David. I'll wrap myself up in cotton wool just for the tennis podcast.
Good.
How's that?
Oh, good. Oh, good. Well, thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you. Lovely to talk to everybody listening to the tennis podcast brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.